Hello and welcome to the AusMed Handover podcast. My name is Darren Wake, and in this episode, I want to try and explain to you why I think nursing is the most unreasonable job ever. Sometime in our deep, murky past, society asked nurses to take on a role that, under scrutiny, simply can't be done. That is, when one looks at the expectations of the nursing profession, they are completely unreasonable. Yet nurses rise up to the challenge of the impossible every day. How and when did this happen? And just why do nurses persist in trying to meet the impossible expectations of an impossible job? To understand when and how society covertly dumped its near impossible expectations onto the nursing profession, we need to travel all the way back in time to well before the monastic era, and well before the turn of the 11th century, for that's where the history of nursing really begins. Most archaeologists would agree that at all of the major digs in Europe, South America and the Middle East, India and Asia, they have at some stage or another uncovered evidence of a healing facility of some kind, and in most cases, these buildings were found in the vicinity of temples dedicated to one or more of the ancient healing deities. Such places were staffed by priests and priestesses of the temples, and healing was primarily a mix of herbal remedies, salves, ointments, and potions, very basic surgery, and overwhelmingly a mix of prayer, spells, ritual, and incantation. The outcome of any treatment was determined not so much by the hands-on component, but by the patient's relationship with some particular god or their personal deity. And if they recovered from whatever ailed them, it was because that relationship was good, they prayed enough, made suitable offerings to the gods, adhered to ritual and, most importantly, made a generous donation to the temple. If they failed to recover, the illness became chronic or they died, it was not so much a fault of the temple or its priests, but rather related to the failure of the patient to maintain a right and proper relationship with their gods and lead a good life, or make a big enough donation. I find it fascinating that even in 500 BC, health outcomes were thought to be determined by a person's lifestyle choices. The traditional role of the healer was comprised of a lesser component, which was the hands-on providence of healing salves, herbs and ointments, setting broken bones and so forth, and a greater, far more important element, which was to act as a conduit between the patient and their god, gods, or whatever form their favoured deity took. That's because the overwhelming majority of people in those times believed in an afterlife, and if they became very ill, broke a bone, or suffered some kind of serious injury, death was the most likely outcome. So it was far more prudent to sort out your relationship with the gods than depend on the very fallible and variable intervention of human beings. Such places were referred to by the ancient Greeks as Asclepi, and by the Romans as Villae Denaria. And there are analogues to these establishments to be found in the ruins of all the more advanced ancient civilizations of the Middle East, South America, India, Asia, and pre-Roman Europe. Treatment was largely delivered by male priests. In those days, female priests were very distinguished and were more often consulted on matters of state rather than health, and the family actually cared for the sick person by providing the emotional support and doing a lot of the hands-on care under direction. They either took them home at the conclusion of the consultation session, if they were too ill to move, or dying. This model prevailed for around 1,000 years, and there's no doubt that it improved as it evolved. Knowledge of the various treatments were jealously guarded and passed down from senior priest to junior priest as part of an oral tradition closely and inextricably intertwined with matters of faith and ritual. However, by around 500 AD, things began to change dramatically. The meteoric rise in the popularity of Western Christianity and the dominance of the Byzantine Empire brought with it an astounding number of changes to the established order of things. dedicated communities were established by the church, and they were tasked with carrying out the very specific religious mandates of charity, compassion, and caring. The First Byzantine Council of Nicaea in 325 declared that a hospital be constructed in every cathedral town, bearing in mind that there weren't many of these in 325, and they were to be staffed by monks and nuns trained to care for the suffering, although in the early days of the church, nuns were in very scarce supply. Sometimes, these hospitals had university-trained physicians on staff, but this was extremely rare. Such professionals were nearly always snapped up by the aristocracy as members of their personal entourage. Rather, the knowledge of healing was passed down from abbot to abbot who directed the provision of care by his staff, and the dominant opinion prevailed that morbidity and mortality was something that was largely determined by your relationship with God. So in many respects, things hadn't changed over 1,000 years, yet they had. As I mentioned, this care mostly took the form of petitioning the Almighty on behalf of the sick person, which is why healthcare was largely delivered by monks and nuns. And this usually attracted a fee, and along with this, they also used mostly herbal remedies of various types and other non-surgical interventions. Surgery, that is, the slicing of flesh or the opening of a body cavity, was rarely, if ever, used on common folk, except in its simplest form. In those times, knowledge of the anatomy of the human body was extremely limited, and dissection of the dead was expressly forbidden by the church. So it was a very long time before an understanding of human anatomy and physiology was able to improve. So basic trauma might be managed, or a military wound, but if you burst your appendix or have any kind of internal problem, you were pretty well a done deal and needed to sort out your relationship with God as a matter of priority. Unless you were super rich or a king, that is, in which case the rules didn't apply to you. Care took place on a day visit basis, in the homes of the sick, and the very unwell or dying could stay in the hospital if required, with their families present to provide emotional support and deliver care as directed by the monks or nuns. The healthcare model of the time largely revolved around spiritual care, some hands-on clinical work, and a bit of compassion. However, in terms of the emotional and ongoing care of the sick, it was largely expected that the family provide this service. Now, it's important to remember this because it's an important point. The healthcare providers consulted to the families, but aside for some genuine compassion, a lot of fervent prayer and some limited hands-on, it was expected that the emotional support and most, if not all, of the physical care be provided by the family under instruction. So they were expected to attend their loved ones. This model was so effective, accessible, because it was also grounded in the principles of charity, and ultimately popular, that it spread beyond its Byzantine foundations to become the dominant model of care throughout all of Europe, Britain, and the Middle East. By the beginning of the 10th century, both abbots and physicians had begun to accumulate a significant body of knowledge about the care of the sick, and probably more than could be passed on through the oral tradition, and there was a notable increase in the number of handwritten texts being produced on matters related to healing. This was an important event, as what we were seeing was clear evidence that the delivery of healthcare was becoming a technically complex activity, and this technical knowledge was being categorized and stored. Undoubtedly, God had final say in matters of life and death, but he was giving humans a fair bit of leeway in respect to how he reached his decisions. This body of medical knowledge began to increase exponentially and, in the context of this podcast, things began to get really interesting. The amount of knowledge the church possessed about healthcare was growing at an astonishing rate. But in 1540 in England, for various rather selfish reasons, King Henry VIII decided to bring about the dissolution of the monastic houses in Great Britain. Now, although it was controversial enough to shut down the monasteries, it was going to be near impossible for Henry to shut down all the hospitals associated with them, as they were the only possible access the poor had to any kind of reasonable health care. To close down everything would have meant relegating the lower middle classes and the poor to seeking treatment for their various health problems from the local village witch, which was somewhat less than optimal, which is not really subscribing to the concept of evidence-based practice. So, to ensure healthcare was available to the masses, over the next 200 years, we saw the slow establishment of secular healthcare institutions. Hospitals as we know them today were built, such as Guy's and Westminster in London. These had dedicated physicians and care staff looking after the sick, and with the significantly reduced influence of the church, their care focus shifted from the reverential to being mainly hands-on and evidence-based. And once we find this situation extended into the Enlightenment, well, boom. the 18th century period of Enlightenment taught us was that although God might be part of our lives, he wasn't necessarily that interested in being the sole determinant of healthcare outcomes. He was happy to let humans take control of that. And three things combined during this period that resulted in an absolute explosion of knowledge about healthcare and the human body. Things that helped us take control over a lot of our own health. Firstly, both the church and state relaxed their restrictions on dissecting the dead, and consequently, we rapidly improved our anatomical and surgical knowledge. Secondly, the focus of healthcare professionals was progressively devoted to learning about and caring for health and the human body and using practices the efficiency of which had been established through evidence. And this was time that previously was largely spent mostly praying for a good outcome. And finally, the development of the printing press and decreasing cost of book production meant that medical knowledge could be easily preserved, catalogued, distributed, and easily accessed. But let's remember that the fundamental model of care in the early Enlightenment hadn't changed that much. A religious consultation was replaced by a clinical one, and although a lot of the care was delivered by physicians and the care staff that were to go on to become nurses as we know them today, it was largely regarded that a lot of the care should be delivered by families in their own homes, or by families staying in the hospital environment with the patient. Certainly this was an expectation in terms of the ongoing emotional care of the patient. Then, as in 500 BC, and as in 1100 AD, there was no one better placed and qualified to provide for the emotional care of the patient than their own family. But things were changing, and the late Enlightenment of the mid-1800s was where, in my opinion, nursing got shafted. Right there at its formal beginning. All the opportunities were there to do it right, and we blew it. As I mentioned previously, a lot of hands-on care, and certainly the emotional care of patients, was handled by their families. I mean, it wouldn't have been that hard to change a rag soaked in some herbal remedy every day, or give a dose of hemlock on a regular basis. But by the end of the Enlightenment, medicine advanced so far that an awful lot of diseases and injuries that were previously too complex to even consider treating were now managed successfully on a regular basis. And with the advent of effective and safe anaesthetic techniques in the mid-1800s, a whole swathe of surgical procedures could be performed that were previously unthinkable. So healthcare had gotten fantastically complex. The acute treatment of illnesses was becoming especially refined and effective, as was the treatment of chronic diseases, and surgery was jumping ahead in leaps and bounds. So the degree of technical expertise required to deliver this care rose exponentially, and we saw the rise of a class of worker that was especially adept at administering this care, proto-nurses, so to speak. But, and I think this was a factor especially influenced by the rise of infection control knowledge, care was also becoming too complex or too risky to be conducted by the layperson in their home. That is, there was no possibility that your average patient's family could take their loved one home anymore to deliver a lot of the care as instructed, and surgery, of course, necessitated an extended stay in hospital. So in the 1800s, we saw a boom in the number of hospitals being built. In that kind of structured environment, expert care could be given around the clock, and it could be given effectively with all of the resources needed. It's important to bear in mind what I'm saying here, and what the numbers involved were. In 1800, only around 1,000 patients a year in the whole of the UK were being treated as hospital inpatients. By 1860, that had increased to 9,000, and by 1900, it was 500,000. During this period of near vertical increase in both the expertise required and the need to treat people in the hospital environment, people such as Florence recognised the need for a defined professional with a specific role within the healthcare system. But what happened, in my opinion, really didn't take into account two seemingly similar, but in reality widely differing requirements of the newly emerging nursing profession. One from the perspective of the rapidly growing healthcare service, and the other from the perspective of the public. The healthcare service desperately needed a role that understood the practical application of technical care, could routinely deliver it to a set standard, and could be trained in high numbers. The public, on the other hand, wanted a professional who could deliver a high standard of technical care, could act as an intermediary between themselves and the doctor, and there was also a third extremely important requirement we seem to have underestimated in terms of its importance. With the increased number of people being admitted to hospital on a regular basis and for extended stays as inpatients, it became economically difficult for families to continue to assist in this hands-on care. That is, most of them simply couldn't afford to take days off work to come in and provide the emotional care for their relatives whilst they were inpatients. And because of the rising complexity of medicine, home-based care was becoming increasingly rare. So over a relatively short period of time, this emotional aspect of care, along with the hands-on component, was abrogated to what had emerged as the nursing profession. And one of the core responsibilities of nurses, in the eyes of the public, became not just the delivery of technically expert services, but safeguarding the emotional well-being of those entrusted to their care as well. But we should wait a minute. Let's look at how the role of the intermediary carer changed over the 1,000 years preceding the emergence of the defined nursing role. For much of this time, proto-nurses provided mostly a mix of religious services and technical hands-on. They provided compassion, there's no doubt about that, but the care of the sick was actually carried out by their families under instruction, and this included their emotional care. That is, the compassion and sympathy extended by family members to each other, especially in times of ill health. After the Reformation and dissolution of the monasteries, there was a much lesser emphasis on the religious aspect of care, but the technical side of things grew quickly and replaced this component. Compassion was still there, of course, but on the whole, until the Enlightenment, care was still provided under instruction by the families of the sick. But then, from the mid-1800s onwards, it became pretty much standard for anything but the simplest of care to be delivered in a hospital setting by expert nurses, and the length of time a person needed to stay in hospital for this expert care meant that economically it was no longer possible for families to live in and provide the emotional support they needed for their loved ones, so this was taken on by nurses too. But wait, the void in the role of nurses created by the shift from esoterically determined outcomes was filled by the knowledge and expertise required to deliver outcomes determined by evidence-based practice. So where were we supposed to find the time to deliver the emotional support to those in our care? Well, no one seems to have considered this. It seems it was regarded at some point historically that we would provide all the technical expertise as well as all the emotional support, and it was like it was considered there wasn't any real burden to taking this extra aspect on. And I think this is unreasonable, if not, for all intensive purposes, untenable. Why? Well, I think the minimum expectations of any family who leaves a loved one in your care is that you provide them with at least the same level of compassion and emotional support that the family would if they were doing it. And that's pretty intense. Now, we can't underestimate this expectation, although we have. A family can provide incredibly intense and close emotional support 24 hours a day, 365 days a year to a member that is sick, and that's what's expected of you. But you're also expected to provide expert technical care as well. Now, to me, it seems wildly optimistic to say we can provide compassion and emotional support to the equal of the family for those in our care, as well as the complex technical care. But what's really crazy is that this will be regarded as a full-on job for the family of the patient, and we just don't look after one patient in isolation. We look after anywhere between 5 and 10 on a shift. So although we might be able to divide our technical care equally between 5 or 10 patients, we are also expected to provide the equivalent of the emotional care and compassion that their family would provide on a one-to-one basis to every one of these patients as well, around the clock. Not the care of one person spread over 5 or 10 patients, but to do the job of 5 to 10 families simultaneously. And no one in their right mind would take that on. It's impossible to do. Except for nurses. So why do nurses do this? I imagine you were waiting for an answer to this, but the reality is, I don't know. And I'm hoping that you'll tell me in the comments section. Day in, day out, we do what I believe is an impossible job, and if our role were created today, I would think that those drafting the job description would say, wait, don't put that in there, no one could possibly do it. But what is equally amazing is that we do it for free, and there's another podcast in this series called How Much Is a Nurse Worth that explores this issue in depth. But in a nutshell, I know we don't get compensated for this incredible responsibility because we were paid on par with those roles in healthcare that have the same volume and quality of training, but deliver only technical services. This is the AusMed Handover Podcast. My name is Darren Wake, and thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe to the channel for future episodes, and please feel free to leave your comments and feedback for us. We always welcome your opinion. I'm especially interested in hearing why you go to work every day and do a job that I think is impossible to do.